Welcome to episode 27 of To the Unknown Pod. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. Today, I am joined by my favorite mountainous presbies. Jim, Tim, introduce yourselves.
I'm Tim Fox. I'm an ordained Presbyterian minister and executive director of the Magnolia Foundation, helping churches to understand and use Bitcoin.
I'm Jim McAndrew. I'm a deacon in the same denomination as Tim, and I work with him at Magnolia as tech support.
Great. And we are here again for another episode of this podcast, which, if you're here for the first time, basically, we spend time on Twitter every week. We spend time talking with each other, arguing about things in very winsome and good ways, but we still have discussions and disagreements. And so this is basically a forum where we can air our disagreements, sort of Festivus all year long. That's kind of what we do here. So we kind of just bring either tweets or just topics for discussion. We discuss them and hopefully, provide a help to people who are also thinking through similar things. So basically, guys, this is our first time I think we're starting without a tweet. If you look at the title of this episode, we have entitled it "The Mission of Bitcoin?" Question mark. We were in a group chat with a bunch of other Christian Bitcoin guys, and one of them asked Dan, shout out to Dan, asked about, can we talk about Bitcoin as having a mission? Is that legitimate? Is that not legitimate? And as we were discussing it, we kind of came up with, we realized that this is not an isolated conversation, because right now on the internet, on Twitter and other places for the last 4 or 5 months, and even longer than that initially, there's been ongoing discussion in the Bitcoin world about op return and spam and all these things and how they should or should not have anything to do with Bitcoin and the purpose of Bitcoin, why it exists and why it was created. So we thought we would do an episode today primarily focused on that. Jim, I'll let you kind of make the case against the idea that Bitcoin has a mission. Why would you say it does not have a mission?
Okay. I would argue that only moral agents can have a mission. Bitcoin is an inanimate object, right? Or technology, whatever you want to call it. So that's the semantic side of the argument.
Okay.
You might just say, well, okay, but didn't Satoshi have a vision? Go read the white paper.
Yeah.
It's electronic peer-to-peer cash.
Yep.
So if you're using it against Satoshi's vision,
Careful with those words.
Not Satoshi's vision. If you're using it against Satoshi's stated mission for what this thing isn't just Satoshi's mission the same as Bitcoin's mission? I don't know. I mean, if somebody discovered fire or invented the wheel because they wanted to use the wheel for something, and then somebody used the wheel for something else, does it really matter who invented or discovered it?
Those are good questions. Tim, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of a non sequitur, because it's like, well, yeah, it's a thing. Things don't consciously choose or purpose things. But things do have purposes. So it kind of goes to how you define mission. So if you go with Aristotle's four causes, you know, what the four whys, why does something exist? Like, well, it depends what you mean by why.
Mm-hmm.
Are you asking, how did it come to exist? You know, what made it? Are you asking what it's made of? Are you asking what it's for? Are you asking kind of what makes it this thing and not another thing? So it's like, in one sense, you know, Bitcoin is a set of code. There's a lot of things made of code.
Yeah.
It's designed to have a certain shape to it. But it also, so I think the most relevant one is this, the Aristotelian final cause. You know, what's the ultimate purpose of it? So like a table, the cause of a table in one sense is like, well, it's made of wood. That's its cause. Its material is wood. But the ultimate formal cause of it, let's say it's a dining table, is to eat with your friends.
Mm.
So in that sense, yeah, Bitcoin as money, and specifically, you know, you get a lot of clues from the inventor. He says, oh man, these banks are doing a lot of funny business with the housing crash. It would be great if there was a way we could have money that was, so you didn't have to trust people in the middle kind of like we used to be able to do with gold. So in that sense, yeah, it has a mission or it has a purpose, but it just depends on what you mean by mission. And then, of course, ultimately, theologically, you know, all things belong to God and they're from God. All of human creation is ultimately kind of under God and for him, even though we can abuse it and use it. So, you know, the ultimate final cause of everything is to bring glory to God. So in that sense, that's Bitcoin's mission, just like it would be with any other invention, is to reflect God and to show himself and show his world who he is and what he's like. And some things do that better than other things.
Yeah, I think where I would, I mean, again, I agree with the caveats that you made and like the different senses in which we have to evaluate, you know, the question. But again, the question of like, from a theological standpoint, why is there something rather than nothing? Like the answer would be, well, because God wants there to be something rather than nothing. And God created the world with a purpose. He has a purpose for both, you know, in both creating the world and in creating the world the way that he did. Like there's certain things that he has revealed that he wants the world to look like, and he wants people to do and carry out in the world. And so there's a relationship between purpose and action and like, you know, existence and action. And we, you know, we all recognize that there, you know, something can be used for purposes other than that which were, you know, they were first used for, or even they can kind of have little side quests. So like if I wanted to use, if I wanted to use a screwdriver as a hammer, okay, like I could theoretically do that, right? I could get the back of the screwdriver and use that to, you know, to knock in a nail. It's like, yeah, I could do that. It wasn't designed for that, but because of certain characteristics that it has, it is able to be used for this other, you know, less efficiently and less successfully, but it is possible to use things for reasons other than they're made. At the same time, there's other ways in which something's identity can be subverted. It can be you know, debased, if you will. So in terms of like currency and people, you know, the scriptures talk about sinful man is having a debased mind. You know, it's, you know, a debased, you know, at least in one level is like removing the base, you know, removing the grounding. And so you can, you know, whether it's talking about people or, you know, you could talk about this in terms of like the mission of a foundation, or a school, like you can have mission drift in all of these things. And I think you can have mission drift in, you know, in certain tools as well, depending on what they are. Like Bitcoin and software more broadly isn't the same type of tool as, you know, a hammer or something along those lines, or a saw or something, because there is more of the person put into it. You know, there is like, there's actual will within the, you know, within the end product or within the tool itself. I think the other reason why I would push back on just the idea of, you know, Bitcoin doesn't have a mission, or like Bitcoin is just code. It's like, well, at some level, humans are just code, right? Like we're all just made up of cells, and so we're just code too. I don't think that we're more than just code. And Bitcoin is more, you know, more than just code at the end of the day. There's people involved, and like Bitcoin can't operate without people, you know, or there's bugs, there's different kind of things that require a symbiotic relationship between the code and the people, which is, I think, you know, we could think about a number of different things in that sense. But the other reason why is if you want to go subscribe to another podcast that we do, it's Thank God for Nostr. We've done a ton. We've read a lot of books about the relationship between technology and, you know, humans and technology. How should we think about technology? And one of the things that we've found in a lot of different books, there's a book called A Web of Our Own Making. I can't remember some of the other super famous ones that we've done, that we've read. Read some Marshall McLuhan books, Understanding Media. And just the reality of like when you create a tool, one example that, or one statement or saying that proves this is, I think it was Chesterton who said, we shape our tools and then thereafter we shape our buildings and then thereafter our buildings shape us. And so it's like, okay, yeah, you know, like we do create things and they are tools, but then, you know, they're crafted, to be used by us. They're crafted in certain ways with certain priorities, but then they have this, you know, concretizing effect on us. Like they reinforce certain, you know, reinforce these ideas, or at least they can. I do think it's more complicated than saying, you know, it's just code, or, you know, it's, I think there is more going on there, but would love to be.
Yeah, I just want to push back directly on the spam, pro-spam people.
Yeah.
So I think the general argument with the pro-spam people is, well, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And if there's people out there that want to use Bitcoin as an arbitrary data storage network and not monetary network, then they can use it how they want to, and you can use it how you want to, and you do you, and relative truth and whatever.
Yeah.
And I think we need to not be afraid to say that there's a moral difference between some uses versus others. And so, even if a majority of people decide that they want to use Bitcoin as an arbitrary data storage network, it would still be better off for humanity if everybody was using it as a monetary network. Mm-hmm. And so that use case, even if it's a minority of people that want to use it for that, is morally better than the other one. So might does not make right. And just because a majority of people think that the other one's better doesn't mean that it's true.
Yeah. And I think this kind of gets back to this idea of like, God is the ultimate creator and God is the ultimate owner of everything, that you can't abstract life away from him and from what he wants, and that we're all ultimately dependent on him. Like Paul quotes the Bacon prophet in Acts 17, in him we live and move and have our being. And so, you know, I wrote something recently talking about how we should seek to have good money and good technology, but that's really only solving half the problem, because good technology can be used badly, and bad technology can be used well. So, you know, we would say the money we have now is profoundly broken, to put it mildly. You can use it well. You know, you can give it charitably. You can be generous with it. But on the other hand, Bitcoin is what we think is really good money, great money. That can be used very badly. You can worship it. You can hoard it. You know, you can use it to be spend it on your own passions. And so you can't just stop and say, well, look, we have this great technology. Isn't that great? And it's like, well, okay, but how are we using it? What is it for? How do we honor God with this?
Yeah. I mean, I'd also just add one more argument in favor of the anti-spam here is, if everybody used Bitcoin to store spam, the entire network ceases to have value and it falls apart and nobody runs it anymore, including miners. They have no incentive to do so. So you just have to ask yourself, if everybody does the thing that I'm doing, will it result in better or worse outcomes for everybody else?
Yeah. And again, I do think there are, it's funny you bring that up. I do think there are, we should acknowledge there are limits to the effectiveness of that argument, right? Because for instance, I'm just imagining you've got people who work for Facebook, right? People who work for Facebook who they are content, what are they called? Content monitors.
Moderators.
Yeah. And so it's like, so it's their job to sift through all of the absolute like cesspool of garbage that's on Twitter that people post. And it's their job to like, you know, find the worst of it and try to filter as much of it as possible. And so they are consuming awful things all day long. It's atrocious. It's horrible. Like there's pornography, abuse, murder, like all kinds of things. And so like there is a sense in which we do have to have categories for moral action where one group of people does something so that the rest of us don't have to, right? It's like what you just articulated, is it effective? It does help us to consider the goodness and the utility and the, you know, it is one tool in the tool belt. I don't think it's an absolute tool, because there are examples like that where, hey, someone is, it's a very Christ-like action, actually. Like these people are serving and absorbing this evil into themselves in some real way so that other people don't have to.
Just arguing that if everybody uses it as spam, it's not a steady state.
100%, yes.
The only steady state for spam is if most people use it for money, and then they can sort of piggyback along on that value that people are using it for money for. So
And related to this,
it's an unstable system.
Correct. And related to this, I'm 100% on your team. I just am trying to like prevent, you know, if there's somebody who's, because again, you've had like a lot of arguments on the other side over, you know, against moral arguments, because we are moral midgets in our age and we're very uncomfortable with, you know, not having a grounding or not agreeing with the grounding that necessarily is required in order to make moral arguments. You know, because again, at the end of the day, it's like, well, who are you? Like, who are you to tell me what I can and can't do? And obviously, as Christians and people who, you know, recognize that there is objective morality, there is reality that's out there that you, you know, you can either ignore or acknowledge, but it's not going to go away just because you ignore it. I think all of these, this is relevant. I'm in this, there's like this Bitcoin philosophy group that I participate in like once a month. And there's some well-known people in the Bitcoin space were in there. So like Troy Cross is in there. Jesse Posner is in there. And there's a few other people, Ella Huff, Hadelbad from the Thank God for Noster podcast. So we're in there and we're reading through these different political texts. And it's basically like somebody, Jesse, it's like a political course about Bitcoin. And so one of the things that is talked about is just law and exceptions. And so we met the other day and we were talking about how with law, it's one of these guys was arguing, I can't remember who it was, but one of them was arguing basically whoever makes the exceptions, whoever is able to make exceptions is the one who's in charge. And so we were having this conversation about law and about exceptions. And so part of the conversation that comes down is it's just about authorial intent, which is kind of what we're talking about, right? And so like there is... You know, people who create things create them with a certain goal in mind. And everyone recognizes this is really important. Everyone recognizes that authorial intent is super important. There's people who are pushing back and saying, well, Satoshi wasn't perfect. So who are we to, you know, why can't we just, who are you to say that Satoshi could ever make a mistake in his larger purpose and that we couldn't correct it? And we would say, well, no one is saying that there can't be some flaw in there. But at the same time, we ought to like love our neighbor and not just think about ourselves when it comes to these things, because one place where everyone is an absolutist, an authorial intent absolutist, is when it comes to, for example, our own wills. Like when we fill out when we complete our will for what we do with our kids or what we do with our money, we want those things to be taken as literally as possible. We want everyone to carry out our desires as if they were the prophets themselves. And so I think that what is revealed, the games that are trying to be played with, you know, whether it's the opportune stuff, whether they recognize their games or not, they're playing games and just trying to act like we live in a place where morality isn't absolute. And I think that's one area where we can kind of just demonstrate the folly of that line of argument.
We've got a question from the chat that I want to address. Blockchain's asking, yeah, do you not think Satoshi's quote inscription was the first direct use of it? So the quote inscription, are you talking, Jordan? You're muted.
So Jordan is definitely not Satoshi.
Yeah. So the whole purpose of that inscription is to prove that there was no pre-mine, which is directly related to supporting Bitcoin as a monetary network, because if there was a pre-mine, then it would undermine the value of it as a monetary network. So that's not spam at all. And I would argue that anybody that wants to use an inscription for data related to a monetary transaction, like a reference number or I'm paying such and such person this, kind of like you do on the wire transfer, that's totally valid use of what the purpose of inscriptions are for. The second you inscribe something for the purpose of a non-monetary transaction, now you're going against the purpose of what Bitcoin was designed to be. So it's clear cut. It's not hard to understand.
Yeah, I agree. I'm trying to think of, man, I had a really good illustration for this exact question a few months ago when this was all going on. It's been a while since I was thinking about it. But I mean, it's one of these things where, yeah, there's really no problem. We all have, this is what it was. It had to do with interruptions. So imagine Jim and I are talking. By the virtue of the fact that we're talking in public, we're leaving the possibility to be interrupted. And so we're leaving the possibility that somebody like Tim or just anybody could come up and interrupt us while we're talking. Now, why do we do that? because there are certain things that could happen that would, that we would want to be interrupted for, right? There could be something that could happen. You know, there could be an emergency with one of our families. There could be a, you know, an emergency in the town where we are. And, you know, we would want that information right away. And so we leave open the possibility of interruption because we recognize, hey, you know, there's a, you know, in there's like things that we couldn't foresee that we might need to, you know, we might need more communication than we think that we need at a given time. And so it's just acknowledging, I think by virtue of having the ability to add some text in someplace, it's just acknowledging, hey, there might be something, you know, might be a situation that would arise where we need to put in something in a limited use case. But to try to act like that is just giving carte blanche to put in, you know, to fill up the blocks and to change the, you know, just to use and treat Bitcoin like your own personal file server is just, you know, I just don't think that's warranted at all.
It's totally obvious. If I want to accept a bunch of payments, like I go and pay for dinner and then people are paying me back, like they need to put a little inscription on there of like, oh, this is coming from John and this is coming from, you know, Bob, because Bitcoin doesn't store user IDs. Anyways,
yeah.
the fact that this is even a debate is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a whole ball of wax. I do think again it demonstrates a weakness in our culture where we're not comfortable with making moral arguments. We're not comfortable. We're just things that would have been looked at as second nature and obvious, like you're articulating, you know, just aren't as obvious anymore. And we could talk about 100 things in that regard. And so, yeah. And again, these things do have real consequences. You know, if you, I mean, like the transgenderism, that's one example. I mean, there's 100 things that we could talk about that were super obvious for all of human history until like 5 minutes ago.
I'm sure there's plenty of idiots that want to go do graffiti on Notre Dame. Everybody knows it's stupid. So.
Tim, you want to add anything else on that?
No, just I have a bit of an off the wall point.
Those are the best kind. Let's go.
The purpose of Bitcoin or the purpose of money or the mission of money or whatever. Jim and I have been going back and looking at the Holzman chapter from the ethics of money production on kind of the moral effects of inflation. And he makes this point a couple times where he basically says, you know, the real bummer with inflation is that everyone has to obsess over money all the time. Mm. And you have to think about money all the time. And kind of the implied point is that the point of money, or at least the point of good money, is to kind of be invisible and to kind of not matter. And I don't know, I guess it's kind of like glasses if we're not talking about fashion. It's like you shouldn't notice your glasses. Mm. They're just there to help you see better. And if you can see your glasses, something's wrong. They're very dirty. So I don't know. In some ways, it's like, what's the point of money? Well, the point of money is to kind of be forgotten, to go on and live for things that are ultimately more important. This is why it's so bad to make money the most important thing, because it's not supposed to be. Whether you're doing it consciously or because you're forced to, because you have to constantly be thinking about investments, the mission of it is to not matter in a lot of ways.
All right, I got to throw this in. That cues up my Dr. Doolittle quote. So
let's go.
Homeschool this morning. James is reading Dr. Doolittle. I'm making sure he's reading correctly. He's learning how to read. Dr. Doolittle says, money is a nuisance, he used to say. We'd all be much better off if it had never been invented. What does money matter so long as we are happy? Right. So Dr. Doolittle's irritated because he's got all these animals and he can't afford to feed them. And his sister just quit being his housekeeper and she's going to go get married or whatever. So now all the animals are like pitching in and taking care of the house. And he's just irritated that he even has to be thinking about money at all because he's busy about his work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I do think, yeah, that the point of like money, the point of money is to enable loving, facilitate loving transactions between neighbors. Like that's kind of, you could describe it in that way. It's very similar to language. And we've seen similar types of, inefficient and against the initial reason why language exists with like the pronoun phenomenon. You know, and like all of these. So basically the pronoun thing is like, hey, I'm going to turn language as from something that is designed to facilitate efficient conversation through a society. I'm now going to turn it and make you be all of you out there going to be my slaves. you're going to have to communicate with me on my own terms. And so it's just completely debasing the reason that language exists in large part. And so, again, I think I hope what this brings out is all of these same problems just express themselves in different ways. Like we're all trying to reckon with the same problems, and they're going to manifest themselves because that's how beliefs are. You know, the beliefs that we have will find ways to get out, and you know it's gonna be costly in terms of time, in terms of effort, in terms of a whole bunch of things when we have to reconcile with non-true beliefs. it's gonna be a bummer for us.
Shall we move on?
I think we shall. Here we go. Darth Powell. Rent payment is reality. Home payments always mean revert to equivalent rents. So here we go. Let's pull up this chart fully. Jim, explain to us what we're looking at here.
So there's a graph and it's got two lines on it. The red line is the cost to rent. I guess this is for like the median cost rent or something in the United States. In the 2006 housing bubble, it was $1,000 a month and the mortgage payment was $1,500, so like 50% higher. Hmm. And then it crashed down in the 2008 Great Financial Crisis to below the cost of rent. So what did it go down to? Around $750. Yeah, where the cost of rent was still $1,200. And then it's kind of been slowly gaining back on the cost rent line until during COVID when they printed all the money.
Yeah.
The cost to buy skyrocketed. And now it's sitting at almost $2,700 a month to buy. So this is like your mortgage, interest, principal, everything. And the cost of rent, while it did also go up during COVID, it went from $1,600 up to about $1,800 a month. So the cost to buy is almost twice as much as the cost to rent at this point. So the question is, how can this be sustainable? And every other time that it's been like this in the past, it seems like it's had a drastic correction in terms of the cost of buying a house. So I personally live this every single day. The cost to buy my place is twice as much as the cost of rent. And there's not really much of a relief. I mean, even if they lower the interest rates, that will temporarily bring the cost to buy closer to the cost to rent line, but then that will cause a bunch of money printing to occur, which will then drive the prices of houses up, which will then make the cost to buy go back up. So, yep. There's not really a long-term solution for this other than real estate being demonetized. So I don't know. What's y'all's take?
Yeah, I am.
Maybe.
Maybe
what?
You know, it goes back to like, I don't know. I've become more and more skeptical of the charts and the lines and the, oh, look, this is going to happen. It's like, I don't know, maybe. It goes back to 1970. That's not that long ago.
Yeah.
I wasn't arguing that it's going to be demonetized. I'm just saying the only solution that I can see is for it to be demonetized. So.
I'm definitely on team demonetize real estate. But there's a lot of people, understandably, who are not.
The rent price represents the utility value. So I can't really understand how there's any value in the rent that is other than the utility value. I mean, is any part of the rent non-utility value for the real estate?
I mean, unless you're, I can't think of one.
I mean, if you wanted to rent, I don't know. It depends what you mean by utility, I guess. It's like, people rent empty houses all the time.
Well, or you might, right. So the question is like, why do you rent real estate? You rent it to be in a certain area and to have a roof over your head and to use it, right?
Yeah. You're not going to rent a house as like a, investment or something.
Well, even if you were going to rent a house and let it sit empty, presumably you're renting it for some reason because you want to like claim residency there and get some sort of tax write-off, or you're going to use it for 2 weeks out of the year during Christmas and you want to go skiing and you just don't care if you throw the, I mean, I, there's some utility that you're getting use out of it. You're not paying rent to take advantage of the appreciation in the price.
Yeah.
Which is what the monetary premium is and the cost to buy. So I don't know. I guess I just feel like we've got a pretty clear indicator, unlike most other aspects of the economy or most other assets or commodities. Like, we've got a pretty clear indicator of like what the actual utility value is versus what the additional monetary premium is.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting to think about. I mean, it's one thing to say, to think about, like, with Bitcoin in this context of, because there's people who are like, oh, Bitcoin's going to reap the benefit of the demonetization of real estate. It's another thing to think about the possibility that Bitcoin could cause, you know, it could be the cause, and I wouldn't say the whole causal course, but like a causal force for some of this. I mean, you've already seen guys like Grant Cardone and some of these other real estate people. I can't remember who else. I've seen other names, but they're starting to like publicly, you know, sell off real estate or take out, I think it's been take out equity from your properties or whatever, and then buy Bitcoin with that. So yeah, it is interesting. Like what effect would that have at scale, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, obviously if you're selling real estate, downward pressure. I'm not even necessarily arguing the blue line. So the blue line is the cost to buy in this graph, if you're just listening, but I'm not arguing that the blue line is ever even going to go back below the red line. And if you look at all the way back on this chart, I mean, it only goes back to 1970, but the blue line is above the red line from like 1978 until the Great Financial Crisis. So
yeah,
you're talking like 40 years.
Yeah.
Of it costs more to buy than to rent. And so like, I'm not calling for some big crash. I'm just pointing out that,
yeah,
you know, especially as Bitcoiners, it's really, really, really hard to get motivated to want to buy real estate.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting to think about how, as things get closer and as like currencies get closer to collapsing, these things speed up. So, you've got, you know, what's the double top here? I guess it did kind of technically there. So it's like, what is that? In 90, there was like a double top. The 90 to 2006, how many years is that? 16. And then you're looking at, you know, like, I mean, we're at like a double top. I guess that was like 2020, you know, 2022 or something. What was that?
I'm going to actually defend the boomers here for a second. Okay. So there's all this whining about millennials not being able to afford to buy a house. Well, you know, I got married in 2006. Granted, it was on the younger side for a millennial. I was like, you know, 22 years old. Well, according to this chart, right after I got married, everything crashed.
Yeah.
And then there was like a 10-year period where it was actually cheaper to buy than to rent.
Yep.
So it's like my prime house buying years as a millennial, just after I got married, I'm like 22 to 32. What excuse do I have? It was cheaper to buy than to rent. So that was great, actually. In fact, it was better than the previous 40 years, according to this graph, right? So
why are all the millennials whining? Well, some of us millennials were missionaries overseas. So not trying to pull the missionary sympathy card.
Okay, granted, I was an elder millennial, so maybe like some of the younger millennials got in there in the tail end of it or whatever, but like there was still a 10-year period that it's like, come on, guys. Millennials are getting married later, they're being adolescents for longer, they're not buying houses, so it's like, yeah, if you'd been on your game and not been a crazy missionary like Jordan, and you'd gotten married, had your chance, so stop crying.
It brings to mind, I was listening to somebody the other day, I can't remember who this was, they were talking about the fact that there is real antipathy between Gen Z and millennials.
Well, right, because look at this. If you had bought while the blue line was lower, then look what the blue line does. You're like rich.
Yeah.
Like millennials got rich off their houses, basically, whereas Gen Z has no hope at all because they've spent their entire life blue line above in COVID.
some of it was that. Obviously, some of it's that. Some of it was like somebody pointed out, like, well, every generation hates their parents. So, like, you know, like that, again, that's obviously an exaggeration. But yeah, I mean, well, it really is.
Gen Z's parents are Gen X, right?
Yeah, or sure. Yeah. Gen X or boomers. Yeah. But like, yeah, it is one of these things you're just like looking at this, you're like, you did have a great opportunity. Now, again, not for a lot of people who are, you know, more millennials my age, you know, maybe you're getting a job, you get married, you know, you're just kind of coming into where you can afford a house. And, you know, so maybe there could be some room there for, you know, people, but
They missed the opportunity. They were farting around. Right. They were taking gap years and they weren't getting married and they were swiping right on Tinder.
Jim is coming hard at the millennials. I did not foresee this coming.
I'm pointing at you, millennial.
there's our thumbnail for this episode. Jim, just big finger pointed.
I can say that because I'm a millennial.
Let's see here. Let's look at the Kobe Easy. We need to figure out how to pronounce this guy's name. Hopefully we will at some point, but it is not this day. The Kobe Easy letter, piggybacking off of this, price cuts are likely coming to the housing market. Excuse me. The number of new single family homes for sale jumped to 511,000 in June, the highest since October 2007. Since the 2020 low, the number of new homes on the market has risen by 230,000 or 82%, excluding the 2006 financial bubble, which peaked at 572,000. We're not far away. This is the largest supply of new homes in history. Meanwhile, new single-family homes in the South have risen to a record 312,000. This is far above the 291,000 seen in 2006, just a year before the housing market crash began. With supply near record highs, price cuts seem unavoidable. Here is a bigger view of this chart. So, yeah, 511,000 here, second only to the great financial crisis. So, Jim, tell us what's going on here.
I love the hopium of price cuts, but I don't know. Preston Pish just gave a take on Natalie Brunell a couple of days ago that's just like, house prices are going to rip. They're going to lower the rates, and they're going to rip. And so, as much as I want real estate to be demonetized, and I'm sure when you price the real estate in Bitcoin, it's going to zero, but most people don't price real estate in Bitcoin, so they're going to rip, and it's just, it's painful. It's painful to watch.
What's the mechanism for people who are, I have my own ideas, but people who are listening who maybe aren't as keyed in, what is the mechanism for the housing market ripping?
Lower interest rates, period.
Yep.
That's it. Like the only thing people care about is the monthlies. So yep. As long as I can afford the monthlies, I'll pay you whatever you want because my wife wants a house.
Wow. Get hitting close to home there, too.
I mean, theoretically, one's wife wants a house.
It is just rough. Yeah, I do. I'm like thinking about this. I'm like, yeah, the monthlies would be nice. So, I mean, what's the largest mortgage right now? It's like 40?
What?
What's the longest mortgage right now?
Oh, it's like 40-year mortgage?
Yeah. Is it 30?
I guess probably. And most of them are 30.
30, okay. Yeah, I feel like I've heard discussion of 40. If they're not already in existence, I mean, yeah, gosh, man.
I don't know, Tim, just
wild.
Do you go short Bitcoin, long real estate? What do you do? Borrow against your Bitcoin?
I don't know.
He doesn't know.
Well, no free ads, but I'll show you one option. I had a conversation and a call with Joe Consorti the other day. Let's see, where is it here? Oh yeah, there we go. Joe Consorti, friend of the program. We need to get him on here. He basically works for this company called Horizon that basically allows you to transform your home equity into Bitcoin. Just basically, you know, do this. It's really interesting. There's no monthly payments you pay like at the very end of the term, which I think is like 10 years or something like that. Go check that out. Look into it more. But yeah, I do feel like there's different answers here. If you're a Bitcoiner, this is going to have one set of potential answers. If you're just a normal, you know, normal or a non-Bitcoiner, then yeah, it's a lot more bleak. But yeah, I mean, it is just bonkers to think about. You think about how much the world has changed in 40 years. If this is going to become a thing to try to cope with runaway real estate prices, if we're going to move to 40-year mortgages as, you know, the the norm, like what was going on 40 years ago, Jim?
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about this. I was talking with Ashley the other day and I was like trying to figure out how much of my Bitcoin would I want to part with for a house? And like, when would I want to do it? Because it's like every year that goes by, it gets cheaper and cheaper priced in Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
And then also the idea that Jimmy like brought up at the TGFB conference a couple of years ago, where it's like borrowing money is you're contributing to the inflation, right?
Yep.
And it's like, at some level, I think it is like a good goal to eventually be able to just pay cash for your house, mm-hmm. even if it's Bitcoin, right?
Yep.
But I don't know. For some reason, when it's like, if it's like 30% of your Bitcoin or 70% of your Bitcoin, it feels like really hard to like pay cash in Bitcoin for the house versus like, yeah, you know, if it's like 1 or 2% of your Bitcoin, you could just pay cash for the house. Like that feels okay. I don't know. Do you think that's like equivocating? Do you think there's any difference? Do you think you should always just pay cash for your house if you can afford it? Like just liquidate as much Bitcoin as you possibly could take a loan?
This is the Bitcoin equivalent of the infamous line from St. Augustine. Oh Lord, make me chaste, but not yet.
Yeah.
Oh Lord, please remove fiat currency, remove monetary debasement, but not yet. Yeah, I do. It is so hard. I can only speak to you. I've said this before on the podcast. It's just like one of these things where I just don't want to do it. It's like, can I make an argument for, yes, you know, we are all men of unclean lips. We live among people of unclean lips. This is really the only way to do this. But I just really don't want to.
you don't want to pay cash for a house?
No, the opposite. I have no problem. I mean, just people who have, through ignorance of these things or whatever, or just like, again, looking at bigger picture realities, like, hey, I want to, you know, do these things, be able to do these things. And so they're like, all right, listen, I'm going to take out a mortgage. Yes, it's technically debasing everyone. Yes, that's not good. You know, but it's like, so the people who've made that decision, I think it's deficient at the same time, like morally deficient. And yet at the same time, it's like how much can you really just fight against these things? I go back and forth. And yet at the end of the day, the reason I haven't done it to this point is I'm like, I just don't want to. I just don't want to, you know, expand the monetary, you know, supply and do this. And so it's like, all right, then the pragmatic side of me is like, okay, so what am I doing? Well, I'm renting. And at least for now, paying less to rent than I am, you know, than I would be to buy. And so I'm just taking that money and I'm keeping it in Bitcoin. And so I'm like kind of trying to, you know, benefit from that as well as I can. Like that's, but yeah.
When you buy a house, you're going to do it with cash.
I have not made this decision yet. I'm just telling you where I'm at right now.
Okay.
But yeah, it really is. What you're laying out is it's the immorality of the system. Like it really is. I mean, like just think about it. It's entirely feasible that Trump will get his yes man in the Fed. He'll get rid of Powell. He'll get somebody in there who will drop it. Do you actually think it's possible for him to drop it down to 1% like he's talking? Is that even?
I think it's totally on the table.
Yeah. I mean, but then you're just going to get crazy inflation. And then is the plan like, I mean, at least he won't be around for it. Or like, what is the.
They want to pump asset prices. Trump owns a lot of assets.
Yeah. Gosh, dude. So yeah, it's totally conceivable that we could get runaway, you know, double home prices again. And then I really am screwed. Like I'm set back from being able to buy.
Except that your Bitcoin's 10X.
Sure. But it's like, it's 10Xing over what time period?
The same time period as real estate going 2X.
Yeah. Okay.
So the real estate became 5 times cheaper for you.
Yeah, exactly. So again, so that's the godliness.
But you still have to give up your Bitcoin at the end of the day.
That's the godliness with contentment is great gain side of things where, again, I am grateful for Bitcoin. One of the reasons why I'm grateful for Bitcoin is because it does, or at least to this point, it has allowed you to not have to play the devil's game and still win at the end. I don't think that's the reason why we do it, but I'm just grateful for something that does, at least at this point, it has enabled that.
All right. Should we move on to Tim's? Did you have one, Tim?
Okay. So this is me, like everybody else, just going off of something I found on Twitter. Could be completely AI generated for all I know.
Yeah.
But it looks real. So I'm going to go with it. Apparently this is from a catalog, kind of like, what Sears catalogs used to be, where you could, you know, people used to be able to like order a house and you pay in a catalog, in a Sears catalog. A lot of these Craftsman homes around America were these, you know, house by mail things where you get the kit and you build your house and they're relatively simple. Apparently they used to have the same kind of thing for building a church. And, this is from 1882. If you turn to the next page, it's a bunch of church plans. Here's a church you can have. I mean, it's probably not the nicest building in the world, but it, you know, it seats like 200 people. And 1882, the cost is between $6,000 and $10,000 to build this church building to seat 200 people. When I was pastoring a church in Austin, we bought a building, and then we did a building campaign to renovate it because it was in terrible shape, and we were trying to do very minor renovations to it. And it was just absurdly expensive and getting more and more and more expensive just to do pretty small things. So it's just, I mean, just again, one of these things bemoaning kind of inflation and real estate. And granted, in 1882, things were not nearly as heavily regulated as they are today, for good and for bad. There are no ADA ramps in this church building. There's no fancy smoke machines. There's no cry room. There's no youth room. This is very bare bones.
Yeah.
But as you can see, it's a nice, simple, beautiful church building that seats a couple hundred people. I ran it through an inflation calculator online. I said, hey, $8,000 in 1882, what is that worth today? It comes out to about $250,000. I mean, if you could build a church building today for $250,000 to seat 200 people that looks like that, it doesn't look like a dumpy warehouse. It's like, that's amazing.
What year is it, Jim?
Crazy.
Or what year is it, Tim?
1882.
Okay. 1882.
So I don't know, just one of these kind of little things about how much has changed, you know, under the monetary system we're under and how much this affects churches and ministries, how hard it is to build things and even simple but beautiful things.
Yeah, I'm trying to, I wanted to look up what was the price of gold in 1882. It was just a dollar, right? It was like an ounce of gold was a dollar, correct?
Well, I don't know. There was the official price and there was the market.
Sure. But let's say if it's, I mean, so then you're talking about how much, so you're talking effectively 6,000 to 10,000 ounces of gold.
That's unreal. Well, no, an ounce of gold would have been $20.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. You're right. Ounce of gold, $20. You're right. But still, I mean, you just do the math on that. I bet you that, I mean, that gets crazy quick too. This is the comment below, Tim. You've seen this here. Hold on, sorry. I just realized I'm not sharing it. There's the same guy who wrote the tweet. Put this below. This also makes me wonder if a lot of smaller churches out west and in the Rust Belt look the way they do, not so much because of intentional decisions to look Gothic, but rather to reflect what Americans at the time thought churches in boomtown should look like and what they could get past the town council or the planning board. Yeah, somebody else had a tweet about how, because like right now they're basically saying like you have, like, it's difficult to have churches because of zoning reasons. There's like limitations on where churches can be, just like modern zoning regulations. And so this person was trying to make the argument that if we got rid of a lot of these zoning laws, you could have, you know, it would have, they were questioning how it would affect, you know, like what type of churches, where they would be. And the, cause like basically this person was trying to argue that for a lot of people, their church is 20 minutes away from, you know, like they're, that's not like it's right down the street because of these different zoning laws. All these things are fascinating. Jim or Tim, what's the other one you had?
Michael Foster on modesty.
There it is here.
Just an interesting little reflection on Proverbs 29:11.
Shoot, where did I send that one? Can you text it to me again? I think I copied the wrong one.
Let's see here.
I just texted it to you.
Cool. Signal. Boom. There we go. All right. Here we go. This is from Michael Foster, who's a pastor in Ohio. He also works for Maddox, which is a power generation company. They create like on-site power generation for a whole bunch of businesses, including Amazon, Tesla, and not least of all, Bitcoin mining companies. So let's take a look at what Michael has to say. Michael also spoke at the Thank God for Bitcoin conference in Nashville a couple years ago. I'm trying to get him, trying to see about getting him back for this coming year. Here we go. Just introduce this for Proverbs, Tim, and then, yeah.
Proverbs 29:11, a fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. And so, you know, this is one of the many Proverbs on wisdom and speech, wisdom and expression, wisdom in words, wisdom in thoughts. But Michael Foster takes it in an interesting direction. He talks about this in terms of modesty, which I had never thought of this before. You know, typically you think of, in kind of Christian circles, you think of modesty and immodesty in terms of your dress, typically applied to women, but could also apply to men, of course. Those of you who, you know, want to walk around in church in your little tiny workout shorts and show off your awesome quads, maybe not. But anyways, he, just him talking about, you know, this aspect of immodesty being giving full vent to your body. And I've just been, and he didn't quite dig it this way, but I've been thinking about it in terms of modest or immodest speech or modest or immodest kind of ways that you present yourself to other people. And that there are all kinds of ways that we can give full vent. You know, I think Bitcoiners, you know, we have a lot of opinions. We're really excited. We're really passionate. We're really mad. And I think we tend to probably be quite immodest, not least probably because we spend too much time on social media, and that's just, you know, one giant immodesty machine, visually and verbally. So I don't know. I've just been thinking about this and thinking about what, how do you be wise with things that you could be angry about and should be angry about, or things that are wrong or things that are broken. But, you know, when and how is it wise to not say anything or not do anything or just keep it to yourself, even if you could? You know, this is one of the million-dollar questions of wisdom and leadership is just because you can doesn't mean you should. And knowing what battles to fight, what hills to die on. So, I don't know. I think probably for most of us, again, is cowardice a danger? Of course, there's plenty of cowards and there are plenty of scaredy cats. But for many of us, especially if you've been around Bitcoin for a while and you're all pumped up and jacked up and angry and everyone else around you is an idiot and they don't get it, you probably need to think long and hard about keeping things to yourself a little more and being a little more quiet and a little more modest. So anyways, could also apply too to finance and how you spend your money, how you use your money. You know, there's kind of that Bitcoin joke, you know, when Bitcoin hits a million, there'll be signs, you know, and people post crazy, silly things about what they're going to do when Bitcoin goes to a million. And it's like, okay, you know, even if you could do that, should you? You know, this whole principle that Jesus talks about, you know, not letting your right hand know what your left hand is doing and giving in secret and praying in secret, these kinds of things apply just as much to us today.
Maybe we should bring up Max's latest immodest post.
speaking of someone who struggles with modesty, let's see.
We love Max, but you know.
Yes, of course.
Sometimes he crosses the line.
Yeah, we're both in his physical dress. Max is renowned for his short shorts. Let's do this here.
That doesn't particularly cause me any problem.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim. Before we show this, I think that one of the things is, it's interesting, right? Because the reason why we wear clothes is because we have shame, right? It's we have shame, and God gave us clothing to cover our shame. And, you know, like the desire to just remove that clothing, right? And just like to glory in our shame, you know, to use a scriptural description or a verse that kind of talks about this temptation for us is, I think that's a super appropriate thing to bring up, especially, again, we are men of unclean lips living among arguably one of the least modest generations that's ever existed. Here we are. Here's Max. Had this to say. Let's click on the original tweet first here. So Michelle, semi-friend of the program, I talked with her a couple times. As cool as it's been to have Luke and Adam, so they've been arguing about the opera turn and all this kind of stuff, spam. As cool as it's been to have Luke and Adam back arguing my own comments, my stance has evolved. Ossify, trust no one. Ossify basically means just don't make any more changes to Bitcoin. You know, effectively just let it, you know, let it become frozen. No more changes because there's so many untrustworthy actors. You never know why somebody's doing something. And so even if something looks legitimate and it looks totally okay, like with, you know, their most recent update to Bitcoin, everyone thought was like, hey, you know, this, it went through. People were kind of surprised by how fast it went through and how, you know, not very controversial it was once things came down to it. And then it ended up with this bug that allows more spam, that allows all these kind of things. And so people are super skeptical. And so Michelle posts that, and then Max goes hard in the blasphemous paint and says, Bitcoin is God's second attempt to save humanity after we killed his son. We might blow it this time too, sadly. Ironically, even if humans go extinct, Bitcoin will keep going. Tim, I'm going to let you as the the pastor, I'm going to let you take that one.
Oh. Max, go to church, brother. Go to a Bible study, please.
Yeah, Jim, you have any anything to add here?
I mean, well, two things. One, I don't understand Bitcoin will keep going even if humans go extinct. I mean, somebody has to run the infrastructure. Like, there's no grid, there's no network. If there's no electricity and there's no internet, then Bitcoin goes extinct. So,
yeah,
I don't understand that part of the comment. But then I do think that there's a non-zero probability that Bitcoin's code could have been written by not a human, possibly the angel Gabriel. This is working theory. But I wouldn't go so far to say that God views that as his second son. I can't make that leap.
You should be a lot more confident saying that, Jim. Don't hedge that, please.
Okay. No hedging on that one. But can we at least all agree there's a non-zero probability that could have been written by not a human?
I don't know where Gabriel came from. I just want to know where the confidence to put a name came from.
Well, if you think about like the various angels that are presented in the Bible, Gabriel seems to be the one that most closely fits the bill.
Communicating.
I wouldn't put Michael there. Michael's more of a warrior kind of guy. I don't know. I mean, maybe.
I heard a podcast recently with the cold card guy, NVK, and he was going on and on about what a piece of crap Satoshi's code originally was. And they made all kinds of mistakes and definitely caused me to lose faith in Jim's theory that an angel had something to do with it.
I mean, I'm a fairly accomplished software developer and I've read the code and it looks pretty otherworldly to me, but maybe I'm just lucky. Maybe I'm an idiot.
But you've looked at the original code, what it looked like originally, or you've looked at it now that they've had everyone and their mom go through and clean it up?
Oh yeah. I've looked at the original source.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like, again, to bring up a repeated, metaphor here. I feel like the mosquito in the nudist colony. There's a bunch of things we could bring up. I do think, again, I do think there is something. I like the instinct. Okay, as somebody who's, you know, more Theopolitan, who, you know, appreciates Tim, what am I talking about? Not metaphors, but like in the typology, someone who likes the typological reading, you know, and sees the, you know, validity in those. I like where he's trying to go here. The problem is that I would have, and I guess there is a sense, if we're not going to be pedantic, there is a sense in which, humanity did kill God's son and, you know, we did blow it. Okay. But like, you know, that was before the foundation of the world. God had a plan, you know,
the plan.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, he's half right. Bitcoin could fail and likely will fail eventually, you know, in the grand scheme of history, just like all human endeavors do. But on the other hand, you know, no, humanity did not ultimately blow it with Jesus, because Jesus is humanity. Jesus is the ultimate human family. Yep. Jesus came back from the dead. That's the whole point.
Yes.
If all that happened is what Max said, that Jesus died, that he got killed, then it all was a big flop.
we of all people
God ruined it.
Are the most to be pitied.
You know, he leaves out a very small detail. Jesus rose from the dead, yep. You know, as the new humanity. So,
also, if we hadn't killed Jesus, how would we be saved?
Yeah. Yeah. And so again, these are great points. But again, yeah, I think this does illustrate. I was thinking about this today, too. Something else. I was thinking about a decision that we have to make, and was just like sitting there. I wasn't worrying, but I was starting to think about like, okay, well, how am I going to do this? And then it just like hit me like, hey, like the Lord knows, and I was like, oh yeah, he does. Like I don't need to freak out. I just need to just trust. Right now, just trust and like present my cast my cares on him, and he knows what we need. And so, but just the reality that like, God already knows. And so if you have that confidence, again, I think I've told people all the time, like, listen, Bitcoin could fail. And if Bitcoin fails, I'm not going to sit there and be twiddling my thumbs, you know, like freaking out, because God's done more with less. And so, but with that said, I hope that Bitcoin doesn't fail, because it enables a whole bunch of really good, kingdom advancing stuff on a whole host of levels. It is. Yeah. I just do think we see all throughout scripture, God allows things to get really dark and then he rescues us. And so, you know, whether that's happening with Bitcoin or without Bitcoin, we can still trust God and just know, we should put our trust in God ultimately. And you just go to him and just ask him to continue to provide for our needs.
I like that Max is thinking about Jesus.
I do. Let's go. Sign me up.
Yeah.
We are coming up here just across the hour mark. We want to honor our folks' time here. So, Tim, Jim, anything else you guys want to add before we sign off?
Yeah, I'd give a word of encouragement to the millennials and Gen Z. The Lord knows you need a house. So, yeah.
Yep.
It may be renting for a while, and that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, The other thing is just, hey guys, keep your eye peeled on that chart there, because there's the potential for not that one, but the original one. I mean, like, listen, you're entirely possible that you could have an opportunity sooner than you're imagining. So freaking out.
I do think, unfortunately, and this is something I've lamented, is it's unfortunate that we live in this world where choosing your housing has to be like this potentially financially ruinous decision, depending on like when you do it. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice if the house price was just kind of steady with population growth. So I think there are triggers, like Jerome Powell gets out of office or whatever, and there's a new guy, sheriff in town, they lower the rates or whatever. You might want to be pretty quick to act, because those are inflection points. And if you don't get on the train, you can get left behind. So
yeah,
you might want to just be paying attention now and preparing yourself, whatever that means, you know, whenever your lease is going to end, or you're saving up money for a down payment or whatever. You don't want to get caught off guard.
This is a full conversation to be had here another day, but this is one place where there's a verse that comes to mind. I've thought about a number of times recently. It's that those who are strong have, I can't remember where it is. Maybe Tim, you'll know. Those who are strong have an obligation to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please themselves. Do you know where that is located? Is it Romans?
Oh. Sounds like Paul.
You're muted, Tim.
Romans 14, maybe?
That sounds right, yeah. And so
Romans 12.
I think that there's a lot of, I think that if you are a baby boomer and you do have a bunch of resources, I do think that this is one of, especially if your kids or grandkids, like Bitcoin, this is one of the reasons why I think Bitcoin is such a big deal, because you can start setting aside money for your kids and grandkids. You can start, you know, in other people, even people in your church, you know, you could set aside a percentage of your wealth in Bitcoin and plan to, you know, just, you know, basically say, hey, I want to help people in my church be able to afford homes. I want to give them, maybe even if it's just a down payment, you know, if you can help in some way like that. I do think these are ways that Christians should be creatively thinking and looking to, you know, love their neighbors in unorthodox and timely ways. So we'll leave it there for today. Grateful for you guys. We'll be back soon, Lord willing, on Tuesday with, I believe, Oshawa will be returning. He's not far from home, dropped his daughter off at college, things are good to go, and they're driving back across the country. So hopefully we'll have him, and I believe Matt will be back. No, Matt's still out there. Matt's gone for like a month. Matt is in Italy right now with his family. He'll be there for a full month, having lots of fun, but we'll be back with at least Oshawa and Ryan on episode 28 of To the Unknown Pod. We're grateful for you guys. Go follow, like us on YouTube, like and subscribe as a humongous help, and then you can follow us on Twitter. We have all of our Twitter handles right here. You can go back and find them if you don't see them right now. We'll see you guys in the next episode. God bless.